Hello and welcome to the Whizzing Cricket Weekly podcast. Before we start today's show, how does the offer of free beer sound to you? As a loyal listener of the show, we'd like to reward you with just that, free beer. Thanks to our friends at Beer 52, the UK's most popular craft beer discovery club, you have the opportunity to sip 8 free exclusive craft beers from all around the world. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/Whizzing and just cover the £4.95 postage fee and the beers will be delivered to your doorstep. As well as the beers, you get a magazine and a snack as part of the deal. They send subscribers a crate of beer every month and there's a different theme for the beers each month. You're able to pause or cancel your subscription at any time. Anyway, on with the show. Today is an Almanac special to coincide with the release of the 2020 Whizzing Cricketers Almanac. With me to talk about it is the editor of the Whizzing Almanac, Lawrence Booth, and the magazine editor of the Whizzing Cricket Monthly magazine, Joe Harmon. Thanks for joining me both. First, Joe, how are you doing?
All right. I feel like not much has changed since we last spoke. But that was 2 weeks ago, wasn't it? Still yet to unpack the skipping rope. That's still waiting for a really quiet time, I think. We're doing quite a lot of running, quite a lot of writing. See, strange times, but I don't know, it could be worse from my own personal perspective.
And Lawrence, how have you found the great lockdown so far?
Interesting. We've got a little toddler who's not quite climbing up the walls but not far off it, so I was just saying how we kind of got used to the new normal. It's going to be weird if and when she goes back to nursery, so we're all clinging on in there.
So first off, Joe, I was wondering if you have any standout memories of Whizzing Almanacs as a child. Did you collect them? Did you read them every night before you went to bed?
Oh my god, you put me on the spot here, haven't you, Yaz? I always got bought one for Christmas when I was way too young to really know what it meant or be able to read it. So it was a kind of collector's item before it was something I read. And it was probably only when I was about 15, 16 that I actually started opening them because, sorry, no offence here, Lawrence, but as a young kid, they didn't look like the most appealing things to kind of flick through at the time. Obviously now I'm a devoted reader. I've enjoyed reading good chunks of it this morning, actually, which I guess we'll be coming on to.
As a child, personally, I actually really loved them. I don't know why, but we had one in the house that had Jab and me and Dad's final career numbers on it. So for some reason, I had the number 8832 etched in my mind as a number of test runs that he scored over the course of his career. And at one point was my, it's fine to say this now, but it was my PIN code once, 8832, which is like the most memorable number etched in my head. But yeah, I used to read them semi-religiously growing up. Laura, it's kind of related to self-isolation and all that. I saw that the 2020 Almanac was printed and bound in Italy, which has obviously been under lockdown for a lot longer than we have in the UK. Did that affect the production of this year's Almanac at all?
No, it affected our blood pressure. I mean, the last few Whizzings have been printed in Italy. This is printed in North Italy, as it happens, but not one of the specific areas that went into lockdown earlier than other parts of the country. If you remember, I think they had 16 million people went under lockdown at one point, but this wasn't in that area. The factory, the printers kept going, and there were apparently a couple of roads out of Italy for goods to come and go. So, I mean, at one point we thought, we're not going to have a Whizzing on time this year. So it was a miracle, really, that it all landed in time in the UK. And I don't know what hats off in Italian is, but I'd like to say it right now.
To people who've never bought an Almanac before, what actually is it?
Well, in essence, it's a record of the previous calendar year's cricket all around the world, but majoring on English cricket. It has some statistics in the back, which it's probably been most famous for down the years, the Whizzing records. But increasingly over the last few years, as the internet has taken over cricket statistics, we have to draw more attention than we have done previously to the words in Whizzing. And there are about 250 pages of what we think of as good writing at the front of the book. So it's a book to read as well as to browse through and to record things, and it's serious and it's whimsical and it tries to look at cricket from all kinds of angles.
One of the things that the Almanac is most well known for is the 5 Whizzing cricketers of the year that are named in the Almanac. So do you want to name who the 5 are this year?
Yeah, it's Jofra Archer, Pat Cummins, Manus Labuschagne, Elise Perry and Simon Harmer. So they're the 5 we've gone for.
The first time ever you am I right in saying that you wrote a bit of an explainer?
Yeah.
The almanac itself. So do you want to talk about why you decided to do that this year?
Yeah, this year was difficult. There were lots of people who could have made it. I expect to get even more flack than usual when the five are announced on social media. Partly because lots of people had a good case. You know, someone like Mitchell Stark would have had a good case, or Jack Leach, or Josh Hazlewood, or Jason Roy. You know, there's no right or wrong answer about any of these things, but I think the five we've ended up with are strong. There could have been five other strong ones too. So I felt like it was worth just explaining how we do it, and it's not a personal insult if you're not chosen. And it was probably the toughest year of the nine I've edited so far.
Joe, what are your initial thoughts about the five?
Well, initially I was outraged that Kane Williamson wasn't included, and then remembered that he had won it previously. Can't blame you for that one. I suppose I was actually thinking about this a few months ago. I was thinking what a difficult task you would have this year. I just remember the year previous, they didn't feel like there were too many arguments really about the five. It might have felt a bit different on social media to you, Lawrence, but that it didn't seem like you could argue the case against any of the five too easily. And the same, you can't argue against them this year, but there are so many other contenders. I mean, Dom Sibley was another one you didn't mention there, but in any other year, he would have to be right in amongst it because he was just stood so far out from the crowd in terms of runs scored in a difficult summer in the county championship. And another thing, I actually just wanted to get your thoughts on this, Lawrence, because you don't necessarily say this and you explain a bit. It looks like the selections still feel like they lean more towards test cricket, long format cricket, in the sense that no Stark, for instance, Labuschagne is in there over Rohit Sharma or Jason Roy. Is that a conscious decision? Does test cricket still come first for the Wisden editorial team, or is it a kind of semi-conscious thing when you're deciding these candidates?
I think it would be subconscious if it did exist. I think you're looking at the overall balance of the summer and what impact was made. And that, of course, that is open to interpretation. But let's take Rohit Sharma, for example, who, you know, broke the record 500s in the World Cup and any other year would have walked in. But because the benchmark was so high this year, we looked at, in India's big game in the World Cup, the semi-final against New Zealand, he was out for one. And now that sounds like really harsh reason not to include him. But he wasn't the only opener who flourished in the World Cup. You know, a lot of openers did very well. He did a bit better than the others. But if you're looking at an absolute standout from the year, we decided that Sharma didn't quite tick the box. Now, you might say, well, why does Labuschagne beat him, for example? Labuschagne felt like a really good story. He began his Ashes as a concussion substitute for the best batsman in the world, and somehow ended up strengthening Australia despite the absence of Steve Smith for one and a half test matches, and then went on to an Australian summer to beat all Australian summers. So that obviously doesn't, that's not one of the criteria for the Wisden Award, but it backed up the decision in a way. And of course, he scored 1,000 runs for Glamorgan in advance. So, you know, we're taking county cricket into it too. Look, you may be right. Maybe there is some kind of subconscious draw towards the Red Bull game. Mitchell Stark, could we have picked him after he played one Ashes test and didn't play for a team that got knocked out of the World Cup semi-finals? That would have been an interesting choice. I think Jason Roy, similarly. I mean, he turned around England's World Cup, then averaged 9 as an opener in the Ashes. I think people would rightly have questioned that if he'd been made a Cricket of the Year. David Warner, great World Cup, flopped in the Ashes. So who knows, maybe if the Ashes had happened first and then the World Cup second, we might have looked at it differently. I don't know. But that was, you know, those are some of the considerations we had.
You could say even with Stark, I mean, the way he got taken apart in that World Cup semi-final was the kind of enduring memory of that World Cup for him as well, despite early on, in the same way that Roy, as you say, turned around that World Cup for England in many ways, but by the end of the summer looked like a kind of broken cricketer by first experience of test cricket.
Yeah, so I think we tried to go with five who you couldn't really pick any, there were no flaws in any of them, if you like, whereas I think the other guys who just missed out narrowly all had some black mark against them.
As difficult as the decision, overall decision to pick just five in what was such an amazing English summer, some of the decisions must have been quite easy for you. Jofra Archer must have been one of the easiest decisions you've ever had to make.
Yeah, Archer was a gimme. I mean, I think anyone guessing the five in advance would have gone for him. And then it got interesting after that. I mean, Cummins, I think a lot of people would have gone for Cummins as well. He was the best bowler in the Ashes, I thought, overall. He didn't take a fiver, but still took 29 wickets. And he was the only one of Australia's fast bowlers who played in all five tests. That was how highly they rated him. They needed him on the park each time. He had a pretty good World Cup as well, actually. I haven't even mentioned that. And then the others, sort of up for grabs. I've talked about Labuschagne. We've always taken county cricket seriously with a five, and in recent years we've taken women's cricket seriously, and I thought it was the wrong time to stop that, even though it was a summer dominated by the World Cup and the men's Ashes. And if we were going to continue with that, then Simon Harmer was, I mean, I hear what you say about Sibley, Joe, but Harmer was the guy who bowled Essex to a title and indeed a double, which was unique. T20, he was captain in T20, hit the winning runs, 7 wickets on finals day. And Elise Perry was, you know, we weren't going to pick her after last year. We were never going to pick Elise Perry. I mean, she is probably the greatest all-round female cricketer that's ever lived and dominated the Ashes last summer. So, you know, some people say, oh, it's a quirky English book and they've gone with Simon Harmer ahead of Rohit Sharma. And the answer is guilty.
I think in terms of the county pick there, as I say, Sibley made a compelling case. But if you were going to go with one, it had to be Harmer, really. I mean, he's the most important player to any county in county cricket. And then to go and captain them to the T20 Blast as well. And also, it's not just Harmer, is it? He's representative of the Essex success story.
What can you do? I mean, actually, Harmer could have won it 2 years ago and we went with Jamie Porter when Essex won their title in 2017. So Harmer was unlucky then. So I think it was sort of only right that he got his dues this time.
Do you take those small things into consideration? Do you take into the fact that somebody very nearly won it before, or that them being named one of the five represents a wider success story that goes further than just the individual player success?
Yeah, it all comes into the mix. Look, there isn't a scientific way of doing it. I mean, I might pick them and in my own mind justify it after the event. You know, what I've just said there about Harmer, actually, it was completely irrelevant that he'd done well in 2017. It was just interesting to me that I do remember thinking, is it Porter or is it Harmer in 2017? So perhaps it felt like a nice thing to be able to do to give it to him this time, though he did also, it also happened that he actually deserved it. You know, he was the man. So, yeah, it's whimsical at heart, the choice. It's effectively the choice of one person, though I talk to other people, but the buck stops with me in the end, and I won't get it right, but then I'm not seeking to get it right because there is no right answer.
So I was just going to ask, actually, any all online HB directed sold at you for picking to the five?
No, Wisdom, the brand gets a bit of stick. You know, I'm happy to push any complaints towards the brand. But no, generally, I'm the one sort of... it's not been too bad in recent years. I think this year might be interesting because... I mean, Rohit Sharma is a good example. For obvious reasons, that may get some interest in another country.
A slightly easy decision. Stokes was named the leading cricketer in the world. In the editor's notes, you're full of praise for him. You write that of the three modern all-rounders, or the English modern all-rounders, both in Flintoff and Stokes can be the greatest. Can you think of any other examples of cricketers who had such an extraordinary, massive impact on one English summer before?
Well, I mean, Botham 81 is the obvious one, and Flintoff perhaps to a slightly lesser degree in 2005. English cricket seems to deal with these larger-than-life all-rounders. You know, look at Australian cricket, it's never really had it in the same degree. They try to make Shane Watson a kind of larger-than-life all-rounder, and he kept getting hit on his front pad, so it never really worked. But for some reason, English cricket does it, and they, once in a career, probably, they have a summer that everyone still associates with them. And I think 2019 will be Stokes' year, just as 81 was Botham's. I was interesting, I was looking at their stats, and I write about this a bit in the notes, but Stokes turns 29 this year, and after their 29th birthday, their batting averages were mid to late 20s and their bowling averages were late 30s, 40. And I don't think that's going to happen with Stokes. I mean, it may happen right at the end of his career, but I think for the next few years, he'll be at his peak. And I think we'll see the best of him. And that's almost the most exciting thing about him. I think he'll get better and better. And indeed, he won the Cape Town Test at the start of the year after the award had been given, which somehow confirmed, you know, that this guy is still going places.
Yeah, another good question, Yaz, in terms of impact of an English cricketer in the summer. Stokes had perhaps not quite unique, but almost unique opportunity in that there was a World Cup and an Ashes in the same summer. It's not often you get that chance. And to grab both of them in the way that he did in such a short space of time is going to take some beating ever, really. I mean, because it wasn't just how brilliant he was. It was the opportunity laid out for him in the first place.
Yeah, there's a really great line, Lawrence, where you said that normally a Lord's Ashes 100 is a career highlight, but for Stokes in 2019, that was a minor mark on what was an otherwise pretty ridiculous summer. Moving on to the editor's notes more generally, what's the purpose of them and what are you trying to cover within those 10 or so pages? Because you cover quite a lot and you pack a lot into a very short space.
Well, again, it's fundamentally a subjective exercise, a bit like the five. So it's the editor's choice about what he or she, hopefully he'll be a she one day, thinks were the things that were worth commenting on from the previous year. Now, you hope that something leaps out at you, and it obviously did this year with the World Cup, that moment when England won the World Cup. And then suddenly you're left with the Headingley Test, and then you write about that bit more, and suddenly there doesn't seem that much space left. So it was almost spoilt for choice this year. I mean, often the Wisden editor's notes can strike a critical note. The administrators get it in the neck for whatever reason. Last year's Wisden, we led on the 100, which may not happen now this season after all. This year was a celebration, and it's nice to do it to be a bit different. This year we had to celebrate the summer of Stokes, the summer of the World Cup. We got Joss Butler on the cover, the moment England won the World Cup, that amazing Ashes series. We may never have another summer like it, and especially with the summer that's coming up, perhaps the celebrations can last a bit longer now.
You still give your own opinion on some things. So, for example, on the free-to-air debate, you wrote that when the UK next hosts the World Cup, the government must insist that England's games can be watched by the man and woman on the street, not just those who can afford the subscription. It's a forlorn hope. Are you careful about what you give opinions on?
No, I'll give opinions on what I feel strongly about. There will be probably some, if you read back, if anyone could be bothered to read back my old notes, there's probably some themes that keep cropping up. I mean, the free-to-air debate is a drum I keep banging, and I wasn't going to bang it. You know, the great viewing figures we got when Sky shared the coverage of the final with Channel 4, then I wasn't going to do it any year, really. It did seem like English cricket became the property of the people again on that day, in a way that we hadn't really felt since 2005. And I know this argument drives Sky berserk, and I'll probably get some angry messages from people about it. But I do feel strongly that, you know, if you make a sport less visible, hey presto, you're going to get fewer people watching it. And I accept all the arguments about the way viewing habits have changed and so on. But it did feel like a moment for the whole nation, and cricket hadn't had that for a long time. So I was both celebrating that and lamenting the fact that 10 days later they're behind a paywall again playing Ireland in the Lord's Test.
I picked out one of your quotes from that section where you wrote, "Social media clips, likes and memes come and go, but it is live sporting drama freely available that makes an impact instant and lasting." I thought that really summed up, because I was just thinking the way that final unfolded, clips would never have done that justice. You'd have never, particularly for casual cricket fans or non-cricket fans, you'd have never been able to explain to them why it was so dramatic that all these things in turn happened. That could only really have worked because you're sitting on the sofa and suddenly it all starts to unfold in front of you. The Stokes innings at Headingley was a bit different. You could have just watched that and admired what a brilliant cricketer he was and what an amazing moment it was. The World Cup final, in its different chapters almost over the course of that few hours, couldn't have been explained in memes or likes or clips. It had to be live viewing, and really emphasises how important it is that we get more cricket on live free to air.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, also it was a shared experience, wasn't it? You probably knew that your next door neighbour was watching it at the same time, and that you could probably go out your front door at the end of the game and say, "Wow, wasn't that amazing?" Now that's what happens with a shared national event, and I think the powers that be have always downplayed that because it suits them. It suits them too.
I mean, the flip side of that argument is that Sky provide an enormous amount of money for English cricket. What's a practical middle ground that you would advocate for going forward?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sky's coverage has been outstanding. They've taken it forward. My criticism has never been of that, and I also accept the point you've just made that the money they brought into the game has been fundamental. I mean, where would we be now with a season that, you know, that serious financial issues looming, we'd have been in even deeper trouble without that Sky money. That is not in question. That's why I said in the notes that I try to have some kind of compromise where England games at future global events in England are made available to the public. Not the whole thing, I accept that. And what Sky did to make the final available was a brave decision. You know, I tip my hat to them for that. But it also, it would be a good thing for them, I think, for more people to be talking about cricket. because more people might buy their product as well, and they'd feel like they were doing a public service more than they already are. So I look, it's not an anti-Sky thing. It's a sort of, I suppose, a wider philosophical point about why sport exists and who should be able to access it.
One of my standout memories from the summer was that cricket has always been something, with the exception of the 2005 Ashes, that I always remember as something that is for people who have this reasonably niche interest. But actually, what stood out about the World Cup final in particular was people I never knew had any sort of interest in it, but who I don't think were interested in cricket at all, suddenly came out of the woodwork and were like, no, this is amazing. And kind of like part of why I love in rugby, the British and Irish Lions tours, and in football, major championships, is you get to share your interest in something with more people because everyone's supporting the same side. And with cricket, it wasn't that. It was just people didn't really know it was happening, basically. And that was a really nice, amazing thing part of the summer. There are some really amazing pieces in the Almanac focusing on the World Cup itself. So the memories of a Super Over. Or did all 11 players who featured in the final contribute to that?
Yeah, they did.
And then Owen Morgan's piece on how the World Cup winning squad was almost a celebration of the Britain's multicultural identity. I believe you conducted that interview with Morgan. What was that conversation like?
Well, as it came across on the page, really, very open, frank, insightful. I came away with angles that hadn't occurred to me before. He spoke well, for example, on how his strict Catholic background, with its emphasis on family and hierarchy, helped him have a greater understanding of the two Muslims in his team, Moeen Ali and Adil Rashid, and how they might interact with each other, sort of drawing parallels between the two religions. Also, as a so-called outsider himself, a Dubliner, how his experience of being so-called integrated into the England team and the insight that gave him into the other guys who'd come in, and not essentially celebrating England's diversity. And I think for a long time we've been slightly embarrassed in this country about the multicultural aspect of the cricket team, somehow as if we've cheated by handpicking players from other parts of the world. You know, some of our Australian friends tease us about that. And we say, well, no, actually it's a sign that we're open-minded and multicultural, people want to come here and so on. But Morgan has celebrated that and says it made us stronger. You know, the question of Jofra Archer integrating him at the start of the season, people worried about that. Morgan said, well, he turned up at the training camp ahead of the World Cup in Cardiff, or ahead of the Pakistan one day series, and talked to people, and they said, no, he's enhanced the thing, the feel about the place. The bowlers are all, you know, they're all striving for it now. There's no bowler fell away from the pack. He thought that maybe one of them would, quite obviously, and he said that decision was incredibly hard. So it was a celebration of the diversity in his team and the strength that England drew from it.
He says to you at one stage, until the 2016 EU referendum, most of us probably thought life in the UK was pretty harmonious. Since then, it's become completely divided. Now, I know from personal experience of speaking to cricketers, it's not often you'll get a current cricketer who's willing to talk politics. Did Morgan take much convincing to take on a piece like this and to address issues like race, diversity, religion? Because he's putting his head above the parapet, in a sense. There will be a lot of people who don't agree with him or don't think a sportsman should be talking about these kind of things.
Yeah, fair point. No, he didn't take any persuading at all. I mean, I was on tour in New Zealand during the T20 series where he was out there, obviously, as captain, and I put the request through to Danny Rubin, the media manager, down in, I think we were in Napier, the day before the game. We had a good chat, and he was absolutely good as gold. I mean, he didn't need any prompting. If anything, we could have spoken for another 2 hours on it. He was obviously quite engaged in the whole concept, and it means a lot to him personally. He's had to deal with this stuff himself, not singing the national anthem, that kind of business, the stuff that perhaps is the kind of, I suppose, the white English mainstream of cricket journalism might pick him up on and think nothing of it, but it leaves impacts on other people, and he spoke really well about it.
Well, there are a few pieces up front which I thought were fantastic. The Morgan interview is brilliant. The piece on Bob Willis as well by Paul Allett is fantastic and very funny and also quite sad, obviously, given that he passed away last year. I wanted to come back to the memories of a Super Over piece as well, because, I mean, I never get tired of looking over that match, really. But There was just one bit that struck me where Jofra Archer says, even when I was hit for six, I was not worried, which in a way I struggle to believe, but having spoken to him and seen the way he operates, I kind of do believe him. But then what surprised me more is that the faith in Archer from his teammates as well, and perhaps there's some revisionism here, but you've got Plunkett, Butler, both insist they weren't worried. They thought Archer had it under control, which is an extraordinary amount of faith to have in someone who a lot of them wouldn't have met a couple of months previously. And just shows what an extraordinary and incredibly talented cricketer he is, that within that short space of time, a whole team have come to completely believe and trust that he will deliver in a Super Over or World Cup final.
Yeah, you're right. It's absolutely extraordinary. He came from not playing for England to within about 2 months of playing for England to bowling the most important over in the history of English cricket, arguably. And everyone thinking, I mean, look, everyone in that ground that day thought that when Neesham hit that six, it was over. They needed 7 off 4. Heads had dropped. I mean, the amount of England players in that piece who referenced the Carlos Brathwaite, Ben Stokes in 2016 was quite revealing, because they all thought, here we go again. We thought we had it and it's slipping through our fingers. Archer, I mean, he even had the presence of mind not to try to run Neesham out from the fifth ball, which could have gone for an overthrow and that would have been game over as well. So his presence of mind throughout the whole thing. But, and interestingly, I talked to Morgan about that, and he was saying that, I was saying, what did you say to him to kind of keep, he said, you're just checking that he's not talking gibberish and he's got a clear plan. And you look into his eyes, and if you're happy that he understands what his plan is, then it's fine. You don't really need to do anything. And the fact that Archer was such a cool customer probably made Morgan's job a lot easier. But no, you're right. The faith they all had in him was, that kind of cricketer comes along once in a generation. It's why the criticism of him when he dared not to bowl 95 miles an hour at Old Trafford on the first morning just seemed like such short memory syndrome, really. I mean, this kid had performed wonders for England in a short space of time. Actually, just on that piece, before I forget, the one bit I like is when Johnny Bairstow says that they wondered why Mark Wood went out in all his gear for the ball. He didn't have to face a ball. All he had to do was run two as quickly as he could. And he went out weighed down with helmets and thigh pads. And they're like, why on earth are you doing that? So that probably cost England victory in the 50 overs. But they all spoke very openly, and some good memories coming back from them.
There are a lot of small details, though, that I hadn't remembered or maybe didn't know. So I didn't know that Jason Roy was supposed to bat in the Super Over. And I didn't know that Morgan, at the last minute, decided that he would be the next man in should England lose a wicket, because he thought it would be easier for a left-hander. So as calm as Archer was on the surface in the Super Over itself, it didn't seem that England were that calm in the dressing room.
No, I think there were some moments of panic. Morgan said that was the only moment where it threatened to get out of hand. He seemed to keep cool otherwise. Yeah, I mean, he was, scientifically working out that bowling Yorkers to a right-hander, hitting them up the hill would have been harder than a left-hander sort of thing. Incredibly analytical in a moment where most of us would be just sort of gibbering wrecks. And so England had the captain they needed in that moment.
I thought it was interesting, Mark Wood saying that Jos Buttler was between the end of England's innings and the Super Over, Jos Buttler kind of shouting expletives at himself and kind of punching the ground, I think.
Yeah.
Which Wood says himself, you just don't expect someone like Buttler to behave like that, and just shows the level of tension that it got to. A bit I really liked as well was that I think it was just before the Super Over where Rashid says that him and Moeen Ali had decided that if England won, they were going to run to each other and hug if England won. They'd prepared their celebration in advance of the Super Over, yeah, and had all decided they were going to hug each other, which I thought was a lovely little detail.
So you're confident then, Rash, were you? Yeah. That could have backfired.
There was also the moment when they walked onto the field for the start of the Super Over, and did Butler say to Morgan, I hope you've got the luck of the Irish with you, and Rashid said, Allah's on our side, don't worry, or something.
Well, Morgan said to Rashid, is Allah with us today, Rash? And he said, yeah, he is. So it's good enough for Morgs.
And the other piece that I really enjoyed that I just mentioned, the Bob Willis tribute from Paul Allott. Just wanted to ask Lawrence, was it an obvious shout to go to Paul Allott as the person to do this piece? And why was he your pick?
It wasn't absolutely obvious. I mean, I asked around with people who knew Bob quite well, who was his closest friend in cricket, and Allott came back as the name, and I knew they were close. I didn't quite realise how close they were. in fact, we illustrate the piece with a lovely pic taken by Bob's widow, Lauren, from a holiday in Sussex a few years ago, where they're Bob and Paul. They don't know the camera's on them, but they're enjoying some red wine together and chewing the cud, you know, probably about who bowled at the wrong end in 1977 or whatever. And, you know, it's a love letter, really, from Alec to Willis. He arrived 7 minutes before Willis died at his home. And he sort of starts by making a joke about how he almost was late because the train was running late, and Bob would have enjoyed that because he was a train nerd. He knows all the trains and he knew all the trains and bus timetables off by heart. So Bob would have enjoyed that little irony. And it goes on from there, really, lots of insights into a guy that most of us think of as this sort of cantankerous old grump slagging off the England players on the verdict, but actually had this very soft human side to him. And Paul brings that out beautifully.
In amongst all the celebratory stuff, there's also a mention from Alec that Willis bowled 939 no balls in Test cricket. I knew he had a habit, but I didn't know it was that many. That's an extraordinary figure.
It is extraordinary. And he includes a stat from Benedict Lemons, the Sky Sports statistician, that because in those days, of course, the no ball didn't count against the bowler. It wasn't an extra run. It was an extra ball, but not an extra run. And he reckons his Test average would have been 28, not 25, had the rules been different. So, yeah, amazing.
Maybe he wouldn't have bowled as many no balls if it went against the bowler.
No, well, it's funny because he'd always used to get angry in the verdict when England bowlers overstepped. So Paul thought this was a great irony.
Yeah, 900 no balls is not a habit, that's an addiction.
Yeah.
a question that I'm sure you've been asked already, what happens to the 2021 Wisden Almanac if there's no cricket this summer?
Well, there will still be a Wisden next year. So I'll start with that. The only question is how thick it will be, how much cricket we'll have to report in it. There will be some cricket because there was some cricket in January and February elsewhere around the world. So that all goes in. What happens with the summer, we don't know really. And there is an outside chance there'll be no cricket at all, I guess. And we'll have to cut our cloth accordingly. We're talking about it already. I mean, we're going to get this book out of the way, all the PR and so on, and then really sit down and try and nail some ideas. We got a few sort of swilling around. It actually gives us a chance to be inventive. But it's going to be tricky. I mean, I remember thinking after this year's Wisden was going to be a monster because of the huge amount of stories we had to tell. But next year is going to be the complete opposite in a monster in a different way. But it may go down as a collector's item. You know, some of the wartime Wisdens are quite thin, but they're hard to get now. And they fetch big fees at auction. I'm not saying that we'll underprint next year's Wisden, but I think it will be the coronavirus Wisden, probably, and people will still want to buy it. They want to break the run.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask what's the precedent for summers with little to no cricket? So the wartime Wisdens.
There was still some cricket in them. I mean, look at some of the Second World War Wisdens, and there were games played by like the British Empire 11 and the London Counties 11 and Oxford and Cambridge and the public schools and all this sort of stuff. So there are scorecards in those Wisdens. They're just much thinner. I mean, the Second World War Wisdens come in at about 400 pages, roughly. The First World War, even thinner, closer to 250, 300. If you read the preface to the 1941 Wisden, the editor, Haddon Whittaker, explains that the reason that year's Wisden came out in August of that year was because the publishing premises in Mortlake in southwest London had been bombed the previous December. So they'd actually physically lost copy that could never be retrieved in time. So like the report of the school section is like there's just four pages of ads where the school section should have been because that stuff just went up in flames. So we're not facing that kind of existential threat in the same way. I mean, it's a different kind of threat, but there will be a Wisden and we'll reflect whatever's taken place.
On the school section, how do you guys choose the school's cricketer of the year? Because some brilliant previous winners, so whoever picked the 2011, 12 and 13 ones did a wonderful job. I think it's Johnny Bairstow, Josh Butler and James Taylor, maybe not in that order.
Yeah, well, we have a guy called Douglas Henderson does our school section and he effectively chooses it. He's the editor of that section and he's in close contact with a lot of schools. He encourages, sorry to say that there's most of it's public schools, but that's not for want of trying. We tried to get more state schools involved girls' schools as well. The reality is we're reflecting what's happening at school level, really, which is that cricket is played in an organised fashion, mainly at the public schools. So while that's the case, the school's cricket of the year tends to be a public school product. And yeah, as you say, Douglas has picked some absolute beauties out of the hat in previous years. That's almost the acid test, isn't it, in Wisden, is who he's chosen. And he's risen to the challenge pretty well every year. So, and it's a nice moment for the boys who get it. They get to come to the dinner, usually. Well, no dinner this year, obviously, but get to come to dinner with their parents. They get presented with a leather-bound edition. Or maybe not be leather-bound, actually, but a special edition. And it presented to them by, you know, Mike Brearley or Mike Atherton. And it's kind of, you know, it's a big moment in their careers. And we encourage all the schools to have a cricketer of the year, and where they get handed their own Wisden in front of the school and so on. So we try and make it a bit of an event, and hopefully one or two of them turn into collectors. You never know.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Lawrence. Thanks, Joe.
It
has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoy the show, tell your friends. And if you're feeling extra kind, please leave us a 5-star review and podcast app. Cheers.